The British Empire once spanned a quarter of the globe. Britain's cities grew in wealth from people and resources taken from conquered land. In recent years, politicians and historians have tried to rewrite the history of empire. They've argued that the colonial powers helped to enlighten and improve the lives of people in other parts of the world.
There have been some rather important forces in the early years of the 21st century attempting to propagate that old story about empire as essentially being the story of the projection of liberty, civility, order, and progress into the wider world.
In doing so, these politicians and historians have justified invading and occupying other nations this century. While no longer an imperial power, the past still influences Britain and its relation to the rest of the world.
For Britain, it is quite difficult to understand what it feels like to be on the receiving end of an occupation. And that perhaps makes us a little bit too willing to participate in such adventures.
The idea that some people know better and have the right to come in and tell you how to run your affairs, how to run your education, what language to speak, how to dress, there can never be any justification for that.
The wind of change is blowing through this continent. Whether we like it or not, this growth of national consciousness is a political fact. We must all accept it as a fact. And our national policies must take account of it.
As colonies fought for independence, Britain accepted that direct colonial rule was no longer a credible form of governance. But three decades later, a group of historians and policymakers in the West argued that intervention in other countries could be justified if the lives of the conquered were improved.
At the end of the 1990s, there is a whole new mood in the world. A moment of imperial hubris. And we see this in the United States, we see this in Britain and in France. We see the emergence of an attempt to rewrite the story of European imperialism.
For over a decade, I've watched politicians and historians try to reinvent empire. This group includes the influential writer Neil Ferguson, who argues that imperial rule brought benefits to occupied nations. His perspective has been echoed by numerous think tanks and the media. It has also influenced the British government.
The British Empire brought many changes to many people and many.
Their official website poses a simple moral question. Was the British Empire a force for good?
Some of these changes involved innovations in medical care, education and railways. There will never be an answer to this question that everyone will agree on.
We have moved towards what you might call a conservative consensus on empire, where the pros and cons approach is the one that people are prepared to accept. Some good, some bad. A kind of balance sheet of empire. And we nurtured the form belief that the British Empire brought many good things to the world, therefore we should congratulate ourselves and applaud.
I don't think British people can ever imagine itself as people that are colonised. It says in the song Rule Britannia, well, it talks about Britannia ruling, but it also says Britons never, never shall be slaves.
From the beginning of empire in the 17th century, England launched ships to conquer foreign lands. They defeated an enemy on distant shores with cannon and guns, but also arrived with a moral defence of their actions.
We can see the argument being made that in many parts of the world, the English bring with them forms of modern agriculture, which gives them the capacity to make the land fruitful. And it's a form of developmental justification for entering into other people's territory, taking control of it, and making it your own. always, of course, with the argument being made that this is in the interests not just of ourselves, but also of them.
But in fact, it's stealing resources, and in the case of slavery, stealing people's lives.
Well, on a reasonably massive scale. The numbers of people who were taken across the Atlantic in the slave trade are still unknown. The lower estimates we have are around 10 or 12 million.
Today in Britain, there are few memorials to the slave trade. I tracked one down in Lancaster, in the northwest of England. This modest monument chronicled the ships that left Lancaster for the colonies of the New World. The name of the ship and its captain are recorded, but the slaves are just numbers.
For years, I've been trying to have a slavery memorial day in Britain. It's such a battle just to have slavery acknowledged. It really goes to the core of the way history is taught. And a lot of our history books would have to be rewritten. And I think that's the real problem. It's not as simple as, you know, politicians getting up there and saying, we apologise for slavery, let's put up a statue. It's like looking at the history books and looking at our real relationship with the rest of the world.
British Imperial history, as it was taught in the United Kingdom, had to do with telling a positive story about the British Empire. So the British Empire was therefore not about violence, it was not about exploitation, it was about instead the spread of parliamentary government to the world, and with it forms of civility.
Pupils are told that Britain ended slavery because it was a civilizing power. It projected a role which has continued from the earliest days of its economic expansion. That Britain is bringing freedom to the rest of the world.
When slavery was over, the slaves were given freedom, as if it was some kind of privilege.
We conquer not for our benefit, but for the benefit of the conquered. We go forth not to enslave, but to set free.
We could still be slaves if it were not for the generosity of these white people that allowed us to be free.
This argument acquires a particular momentum once Britain, after having run the slave trade for 200 years, decided to abolish it. From that point onwards, Britain could identify itself with being an anti-slavery power, and on the basis of anti-slavery could run up and down the West African coasts, signing exclusive commercial arrangements.
These commercial arrangements extended throughout Africa, and it attracted British settlers to countries such as Kenya. Tens of thousands arrived in the latter years of Queen Victoria's reign. The settlers fenced off fertile farming land and made on foreign soil another corner of Britain.
In the 1950s, Kenya is a deeply divided colonial society that's extremely racialized. It has a population by the end of the 50s of 60,000 whites who live a life of relative ease amid around 4.5 million Africans who live in relative squalor and poverty. During the 50s, of course, the Mau Mau Rebellion erupted in Kenya that was precisely motivated by attempts on the part of Africans to have their political rights recognized. And the resistance to that rebellion, its brutal suppression, was a sign of the desperation with which that white minority sought to keep a grip of its privilege and prestige.
The Mau Mau uprising was led by members of Kenya's largest tribe, the Kikuyu. British colonial forces responded by co-opting wealthy Kikuyu as well as other Kenyan tribes to oppose the rebellion.
Mau Mau suspects were being checked prior to interrogation. All were members of the Kikuyu.
I think it's usually the case that there are forms of local collaboration as one finds one group or another in a society, finds in fact that it has an interest in operating with some external actor. In many ways, we could describe imperialism as a regime based on the propagation of civil wars. Imperialism operates essentially by promoting fundamental differences of interest and separating parts of the elites of that society from the masses.
Divide and rule.
And this particular relationship is one which is created through violence and which is sustained through violence.
Between 1952 and 1960, hundreds of thousands of Kikuyu were herded into internment camps.
The administration developed a rather strange idea that Mama was a kind of mental illness, that people were smitten by some kind of delusion, and that this could be treated by what they called rehabilitation, and that the first step in that was confession. So the British began systematically torturing people and abusing them in order to obtain confessions.
So they considered people who wanted freedom from colonial rule mentally ill?
I think that pretty much sums it up. Those who wanted their freedom were considered to be mentally ill. Why should you not wish to live under the boot of British imperialism?
At his office in London, Martin Day is investigating exactly what happened in the camps half a century ago. He is the lawyer representing four elderly Kenyans who were victims of torture at the hands of British officials during the 1950s and 1960s. They are seeking damages and an apology from the British government. The case has revealed disturbing facts about colonial rule in Kenya.
Two of them alleged that they were castrated during the course of their torture process. One poor lady had a broken bottle shoved up her vagina as a part of the process. So, you know, some pretty horrendous things that were going on under the name of the British Army and the British government.
And the fourth claimant was beaten to within literally inches of his life at Hola Camp in 1959. Left for dead, loaded into the charnel cart and taken to the mortuary. Were only there on the slab did they discover he was still breathing. Now, all of these things are not matters of speculation or hypothesis. They are facts.
When you have been subject to such terrible, terrible actions against you, torture, abuse, it is something that never leaves you. And it never leaves you as an individual, it never leaves you as a society, until, in some ways, it is properly dealt with.
Just for someone to say, yes, these things did happen, yes, you suffered, and even, we're sorry, would make a huge difference to their attitudes towards Britain today.
At the time, the British government tried to explain the torture as the actions of a few rogue individuals. But the case of the four Kenyan claimants has revealed unexpected evidence that has implicated Alan Lennox Boyd, the then Secretary of State for the Colonial Office.
One of the things that's really started to develop as more and more documents have been made available, particularly over the last year or so, is the scale of the actions of the British Army and the British regime out there in terms of torture and abuse of the Kenyans, but also is of the knowledge or at times turning a blind eye to what was going on by the government itself here in London.
What you had was a systemic pattern of abuse that was sanctioned at the highest level of government in Kenya, the governor's office and the war council, and was known about in London because it was being reported directly back to the colonial office and the Secretary of State. And there's significant evidence to show that the Secretary of State and his immediate advisers were well aware of the worst events that were taking place, and that they were complicit in taking steps to cover up or to protect people from prosecution in those cases.
From his research, Professor Anderson realised that key files had gone missing when the British left Kenya. Some had been deliberately destroyed. The Colonial Office ordered files to be burnt or packed in weighted crates and dumped in deep and current-free water. But the case also led to the discovery of 300 boxes of documents that detail the government's involvement in the repression of the Mau Mau Rebellion.
From each colony, we the British took substantial quantities of files, and we even had a systemic, ordered way of doing it. Colonies received instructions with categories of files identified and then made selections, and they even sent officials out from London to assist each colony to do this. So we've now discovered that alongside those 1,540 Kenyan files, there are another 9,000 files relating to 36 other colonies. We took our dirty washing home with us.
I think that the scale of atrocities committed in colonial counterinsurgency in the 1940s and 50s and early 60s is not known by the British public at large. I think that it is not known partly because the British government very actively sought to suppress this information.
I know people who still talk about the British sense of fair play, and I say to them, you name me a time when British culture was based on fair play. So I'll show you that in that time somewhere the British were committing some atrocity somewhere.
Imperial historians have been quite shocked by this revelation, and I think it has led to a realisation that we do need to sit down and reconsider the history of decolonisation.
The Maritime Museum in Greenwich is a testament to Britain's dominant role as a seafaring nation. But while secret documents are forcing Britain to reassess its colonial past, more recent events became the basis of a new doctrine, one that could be used once again to justify the invasion of another country. It happened in Rwanda, where ethnic rivalry burst into open bloodletting. After the murder of their president, Hutu gangs conducted mass killings of rival Tutsis, leaving 800,000 dead. For Western leaders, it sparked the idea of liberal intervention and justified invasion in order to prevent genocide or the killing of civilians.
The only clear case in international relations traditionally for armed intervention had been self-defense, response to aggression. But the notion of intervening on humanitarian grounds had been gaining currency, where in certain clear circumstances, we do intervene even though we are not directly threatened.
The argument for humanitarian intervention begins to pop up in the late 1990s. And it turns essentially on this phenomenon that in every society there are always fundamental tensions. There are always potential civil wars that operate in any society. And one of the curious characteristics of liberal interventionism is actually to promote the very civil wars which they later on can claim to attempt to provide an answer to. So if we look, for example, at the Rwandan crisis, would the Rwandan crisis have arisen without the way in which the French state in the 1970s and 80s had operated side by side with the Hutu leadership in order to secure France's interests in that region?
The backers of a new colonialism were bolstered by another key event.
The second reason, I think, derives from the global war on terror and our attitude to politics post 9/11, is that we see that enemies have a global reach and that even if they do not exist within our boundaries, they have the capacity to harm us.
So it's created a new legitimacy of empire, or certainly involvement in foreign countries.
Well, I wouldn't say that it has legitimised empire, but it has changed our understanding of sovereignty, so that we no longer accept that all states are uniquely sovereign to themselves.
The justification for military intervention today is reusing arguments from the colonial era. It was said then that the world was a safer place when Britain ruled the waves. The British Empire was also promoted as a civilizing venture, And today, supporters of liberal intervention claim a moral duty to improve the lives of others. And as in the days of colonial rule, the banner of humanitarianism has served to promote British economic and strategic interests. And today, it occurs without adequate public scrutiny.
In the case of Libya, the issue of oil loomed large. And that is why I find it troubling that having decided that sovereignty is no longer to be respected, we do not then have a proper parliamentary debate about the circumstances in which we make that decision. Because that decision, it seems to me, is a treacherous one, and one that can lead very easily to misadventure.
The British have this thing about sending our troops to other places around the world to control them and to put them in their place, to police them. But the moment there's a suggestion, as there once was, of even sending aid to Britain, this is seen as outrageous. We can look after our own affairs. Why can't they understand that there's some other people that can look after their own affairs?
In 2003, shortly after the invasion of Iraq, Benjamin Zephaniah was offered an OBE in the Queen's Honours List. He broke convention to publicly reject the award.
Order of the British Empire. I've been fighting against Empire. Why would I want to wear a badge that says Empire? Why would I want to join the club that I've been fighting against?
He invited Tony Blair and the British establishment to recognise that the theory of liberal interventionism was often no more than an updated justification for colonialism.
You've got to appreciate how you've messed up so many people. Don't sit there saying, well, at least I gave them a train set, you know, at least I gave them a bit of a civil service or something. You know, look at the bad you've done, acknowledge it, and then we can move on.
As I ended this journey to try to understand the new imperialism, the glaring truth of empire remained for me brutal. For one group to believe it has a moral authority to control another is simply wrong. The calculus doesn't add up.
Building a hospital doesn't cancel out a massacre. Building a new road doesn't help people who've suffered torture. Atrocity is atrocity wherever it happens, that it has to be dealt with, it cannot be ignored, and that counting atrocities is totally pointless. You only need one. If you have more, that's worse, but you only need one, and that one has to be dealt with.
You need to fully understand that often you are sending into that country a bunch of psychos. That, you know, we are totally clear that when we look at the behaviour of our army, whilst I totally accept that the good majority of them are bloody good people doing a bloody good job, there are a very significant number who are in that army who are nutters, who should be locked up rather than actually being allowed to be free and operating free in a different country. And I think that's true in Kenya, it was true in Iraq, it's probably true everywhere the British Army has been involved.
If we don't acknowledge what we've done in the past, we'll keep repeating the mistakes. And I think we do to a certain extent. People don't know the truth of what it's like when you send young people into fight. What happens when they get bored? What happens when they think they are better than these people? They've come to civilise these people. They've come to bring them education. They've come to free the women. And the reality on the ground is very different. War is very dirty.
Empire was not welcomed and enjoyed. It was suffered and endured. And I think that realisation might be a bit surprising to some people in Britain, but it's an important realisation. And I just wish Britain's politicians could grasp this idea that facing up, being honest, admitting your wrongs helps us all to move on.